Hello and welcome to episode 3 of Canberra Conversations, an occasional podcast series on The Interpreter, where I talk with some of the big names from the foreign policy and national security worlds in Australia's capital. In episode 1, I talk with Mike Pezzullo, Secretary of the Department of Immigration and Border Protection, and now the incoming head of the new Home Affairs Ministry. And episode 2 was with the Secretary of the Department of Foreign Affairs and Trade, Francis Adamson. In this edition, I talk with one of Australia's most prominent and distinguished foreign policy practitioners, Gareth Evans. Professor the Honourable Gareth Evans has been Chancellor of the Australian National University since January 2010. He was a Cabinet Minister in the Hawke and Keating Labor governments from 1983 to 1996 in the posts of Attorney General, Minister for Resources and Energy, Minister for Transport and Communications, and from 1988 until 1996, Foreign Minister. From 2000 to 2009, he was President and CEO of the Brussels-based International Crisis Group, the independent global conflict prevention and resolution organization. Gareth Evans' new book is called Incorrigible Optimist, a political memoir. It was released recently and is available in bookshops and online. Well, Gareth Evans, thanks for taking the time. Let's start at the beginning. Given your early career was in the law, and when you came into Parliament, your first portfolio in the Hawke government was as Attorney General. So when did your interest in foreign policy and foreign affairs actually develop?
Well, it wasn't anything to do with my family background. We were a diplomat-free zone, as well as a lawyer-free zone, for that matter, and public policy-free zone. It was, I guess, initially stimulated by the travel I did in my student days. My first opportunity to go overseas was when I got a legacy from an uncle, which I immediately spent on going off with the student group to Japan in the hold of a ship. Those were pre-aircraft cheap travel days, and travel around Japan individually for 4 or 5 weeks, and had an experience, of course, of going to Hiroshima, which was deeply moving and deeply focused my mind on the horror of nuclear weapons in particular. So those seeds were first sort of germinated there, but more particularly, I guess, in student travel later on, going to England to study in Oxford. I spent about 4 or 5 months on the road, traveling, through our immediate neighbourhood into Southeast Asia and across to South Asia, down into Africa, up through the Middle East, across from Eastern Europe. And every step of the way having experiences which were pretty formative, as I describe at some length in the memoir that I've just published. Going to all these places, I spent a lot of time, as one did, I guess kids still do, hanging out in bars and campuses and student quarters, drinking beer and eating frog legs in Indonesia or whatever. And throughout the course of my subsequent public life, I kept on bumping into people that I'd met on those trips, or if not the actual individuals, certainly people like them in that cohort. But in the case of Cambodia, where I had exactly that set of experiences, I never again met anyone that I'd met or anyone of that generation, for the obvious reason that they'd all been murdered by the Khmer Rouge, or died of starvation or disease or overwork in the killing fields. And that sort of stuff concentrated my mind. Going to Vietnam at the height of the war, as a student backpacker, finding myself in a hotel room which manifestly wasn't designed for sleeping, yellowing sheets and cigarette butts on the floor and unmentionables elsewhere. And, within the first few minutes of arriving in this very, very squalid environment, hearing a commotion on the stairs outside and peering out through the door, saw a massive great GI with a broomstick beating the hell out of a half-naked Vietnamese girl down the stairs. And just the sheer horror and ugliness of the what war does to people in that kind of environment. All of these things made a cumulative impression, I guess, on me, and made me fascinated by conduct of foreign affairs. Race issues were always very important to me. The anti-apartheid campaigning I did as a student and fed into a sort of a bit of a passion for multiculturalism and all its dimensions, and just a general fascination with people of other cultures and backgrounds. So it was all there, simmering away. And when the opportunity arose after engagement in a whole series of domestic portfolios, AGs, pipes and holes, resources and energy, and of course transport and communications, when I was given the task of, rather against Bill Hayden's wishes, to be his assistant minister, I then plunged into the detail of the business of foreign policy, making and execution, and was raring to go when the opportunity arose finally, when Bill left to become Governor General, to take on that role.
But much of what you described there, over the years you've become known not only as a practitioner, but as someone who's contributed to foreign policy thinking, and yet what you describe there aren't necessarily intellectual influences.
No, but I think that sort of came in association with the job as I took it on, and given my whole background as, someone who's obviously got undergraduate degrees in philosophy, politics, economics from Oxford, as well as my law degrees from Melbourne. I've always had an intellectual interest in these things and always read a lot. And also, as someone once described me, I have a mind that craves structures, as someone said, that likes to have things, with some sort of shape and framework about them. So in approaching foreign policy, I was uncomfortable with just seeing it as an endless procession of events, dear boy, events, as Macmillan famously said, what were his biggest challenges as Prime Minister in the UK. It was more than, I saw it as being necessary to have an intellectualised, conceptualised, structured approach to what foreign policy was all about. So I spent a lot of time in my early speeches as foreign minister, developing this concept of, what were Australia's national interests? Were they just the traditional duo of security and economic interests, or so that everything else was merely sort of optional values, or whether the global and regional public goods objectives were somehow integrally bound up with our interests. And so I developed that concept of good international citizenship, which we can perhaps talk about a bit more as one of the foundational elements of foreign policy making. Then attached to that, the idea of having a very clear idea of capabilities, and then working out what your priorities were on the basis of how your interests lined up against opportunities to advance them. So there's all that stuff. I mean, the later stuff that I was involved in, responsibility to protect, the conceptualizing an appropriate response to the issue of genocide and other mass atrocity crimes. I guess that just sort of flowed out of an anxiety which became very widespread during the 1990s, that the international community was just simply not getting it right when it came to dealing with these terrible scale human rights violations occurring behind sovereign state borders, with a big division between the North and the global North and the global South, and the situation crying out for some kind of conceptualized approach which would yoke the two sets of interests and approaches together. And I was always intrigued intellectually by the way in which, in the Green Agenda, Gro Brundtland's commission a few years earlier, International Commission, had introduced the concept of sustainable development as a conceptual way of finding potential common ground between greenies and one side of the global argument and mad dog developers on the other side. It didn't solve every individual problem, but it created a conceptual framework in which everybody could be operating with common concepts and find solutions within that same tabletop. So that kind of approach, it wasn't intellectualism for the sake of it. It was intellectualism for the sake of better being able to solve real-world problems, on the principle that if you can get sort of normative commitment, if you can get normative buy-in to the way generally in which problems should be approached, then you're at least halfway there in getting buy-in to particular crafted solutions to solve those problems.
So you talk about trying to shape a worldview in your early speeches as minister. What are your strong memories of that early period about coming into the portfolio?
One of my memories of Des Ball coming up to me after one of those big conceptual speeches at ANU and said, "Well, that was all very well, but when are you going to say something interesting?" Because he was wanting me to get stuck into the United States alliance or, relations with Indonesia or East Timor and, the big issue. And I said, "Well, it's all coming, Des. It's all coming. I'm working my way into the portfolio and thinking through it, and I don't want to just hair off." The foundations for what I was trying to do in foreign affairs had been very well laid by Bill Hayden in the first 5 years, 83 to 88. I mean, the basic parameters that, you know, our future depended on our geography rather than our history, the basic parameter that the US alliance was not something that should be the be-all and end-all of our approach to international affairs, that, as I've written recently, I mean, alliance doesn't mean compliance. It doesn't mean lapdog adherence to every bolt hole the Americans might want to take us down. And a lot of that landscape had already been sketched, and stuff had been done. The first steps of trying to find a regional solution to the Cambodian problem had all been done. So, you know, we were, our instinct as a government was to do the sorts of things that, you know, I've ended up doing, but we hadn't really spent much time conceptualizing it and framing it and focusing it. And my first months in the job, that was an important part of it. The other part of my approach to it was building very much on the sort of concentric circles that some people may remember from the Defence White Paper of 1987. Paul Dibb, which Kim Beazley picked up so well, where, you know, we described Australia's position in the neighbourhood in terms of, you know, the South Pacific at the heart, the immediate Southeast Asian environment, then the next concentric circle at Northeast Asia, and then the wider world beyond that. And that seemed to me to be a pretty important approach to the conduct, not just of thinking about defence policy and defence capability, but also the way in which we ought to conduct foreign relations. It's not as if South Pacific countries were going to be, at the end of the day, more important than Washington or New York, hardly. But nonetheless, we had to get absolutely right our role and responsibilities and relationships with our immediate neighbourhood. So I, just as a precondition for being taken seriously and having views or activities anywhere else, so I made my first travel priority actually going to the South Pacific, which raised quite a lot of eyebrows. And then I made the second travel priority going to the key countries of Southeast Asia, the third to the key countries of Northeast Asia, Japan, Korea, Beijing, and then, although Beijing wasn't nearly as central in our thinking then as it obviously subsequently became, and only then rushing off to, to Washington to pay obeisance to the great and powerful. And I think that sort of priority setting of a very visible kind in that way itself, you know, sent some messages and made a few people think that maybe things were going to be done in an interesting way in the years that lay ahead. And so it proved. I mean, we did have a very active and very engaged period of foreign policy during the time I was around, and did do some, I think, you know, pretty creative and adventurous things. It wasn't all an unalloyed succession of triumphs by any means, but it was, I think, very much implementing the kind of approach that I did very self-consciously craft right at the beginning.
And you talk about the Kim Beazley and Paul Dibb on defence policy, which invites a thought about the link between defence and foreign policy. How did that happen in your period? Was that something that you did between offices, or was it something that happened in the cabinet room?
No, Kim Beazley and I developed a very, you know, close and effective, I think, working relationship, which had been a bit unusual, frankly, for foreign affairs and defence ministers
in previous
administrations. Well, I won't comment on the current environment, but back then, the Defence White Paper in 1987 was a bit of a watershed, because it was very, very much focused on the concept of defence self-reliance. Now, that didn't mean complete self-sufficiency, because then, as now, we know we do have a massive dependence on the United States for logistics support and intelligence support, and plus whatever deterrent utility its ANZUS commitment might represent. But sure as hell, we could do a lot better in being able to cope ourselves with multiple defence contingencies short of all-out existential war. And that was very much the theme, of course, of that Dibb Beazley white paper. And in that context, I wrote shortly thereafter in the book I wrote with Bruce Grant on Australian foreign relations that the Defence White Paper of 87, in a sense, liberated Australian foreign policy. It left us free to think more adventurously and creatively about a foreign policy which wasn't totally spooked by, dependent on, driven by what we thought our great and powerful friends wanted us to do. And I thought that was pretty healthy, and it created the framework for that. And that's the way I've thought about the foreign affairs defence relationship ever since. Whether that's quite the way people think about things now, I'm not sure, but it was important to the foreign policy of the Hawke-Keating period.
So my background's in the intelligence community. A lot of the people that read The Interpreter and who will listen to this podcast come from that part of the bureaucracy as well. In your time, what was the relationship between the intelligence product that you saw and the decision-making process?
Well, I was pretty skeptical about the product that came from the agency for which I was responsible, ASIS, just as I was pretty skeptical about the product that had come previously from the counterintelligence agency, ASIO, when I had responsibility for it as Attorney General. I don't think at that stage these were fantastically professional organisations. I think they've become much more so subsequently, and have a much more obvious raison d'etre now with the counter-terrorism, countering violent extremism task they obviously have. The defence intelligence side, I didn't see so much of that product coming from DIO or elsewhere in the defence community, and not really in a position to make judgments, but had a sense that its quality was was pretty good, albeit necessarily much supplemented by the stuff we were getting from the cousins. But generally speaking, I also had a lot of respect when ONA was finally established for, the way in which it started to, seriously craft a product which was based as much on open source analysis as it was on the spookery, and I think was the better for it in terms of the quality of the product and the utility of the product. I mean, I remember Hawke in particular loving getting those envelopes with hippopotamus stamps all over them, for your eyes only, and osteo and Christ knows what else. And
Keating was a bit of a skeptic.
Oh, Keating was a skeptic, and I was a skeptic. I mean, whenever I saw this stuff, I mean, it very rarely seemed to add much beyond the much more than a few more layers of gossip to stuff that was already pretty much out there. And I tended to rely much more on sort of open source stuff, diplomatic reporting, and the product of my own eyes and ears as I moved around the world and talked to many of the serious players. But I don't want to sound like a Luddite or a sort of ridiculously primitive on the subject of intelligence. It was important then, it is extremely important now, and I'm just glad that it seems to be being done at a much higher level of professionalism and competence than tended to be the case back in those early days.
Yeah. You talk about, supplementing that stuff with reading the open source material. What are your main reading habits now in terms of media consumption?
Well, I mean, I read the mainstream foreign affairs, foreign policy type journals. I read the Lowy Interpreter and the Aspie stuff regularly. I read blogging from Washington Post and various other sources that come to me in endless streams from various people. I suppose I spend a couple of hours a day just keeping pace with what's being not so much the formal international relations journals of the academics, because they're invariably no less than a year and usually 3 or 4 years behind the play in terms of real world sort of policy stuff that's going on. I mean, it's a universe unto itself. I mean, sometimes that stuff can help you thinking a lot when you're crafting big new sort of normative ideas like responsibility to protect or something like that. And that debate and picking up the intellectual currents and that feed into that and reinforce it or countermand it is an important part of your knowledge base. And I try to keep up a bit of that sort of literature, but mostly it's and of course the sort of reporting that was done by my own international crisis group, and the best of that reporting now coming out of the Middle East, some of it on Africa, is still as good as anything there is. I'm not sure that it's as good as it used to be in terms of the Asia product or some of the other parts of the world, but I do think that sort of stuff that's written not just from computer screens behind the Beltway or in desks in Canberra or Sydney You know, just picking up the current wisdom and, you know, and fulminating about it is, you know, it's all very well, and I've written a lot of that stuff myself. I mean, I wrote regular columns for Project Syndicate for 5 years until I got consumed with writing a book and stopped doing it. But, you know, at the end of the day, it's just opinion, 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 response, response, response. What I like is hard evidence-based stuff, ground truth, you know, reporting coming from people who know what's actually happening on the ground, which is what, of course, we tried to do in the nearly 10 years I was running International Crisis Group, producing just that quality of reporting, developing policy prescriptions that were hard-headed, sharp, pragmatic, realistic, based on that real-world dynamic, and then getting out there and doing the high-level advocacy, the direct access to ministers and so on, that that gave you a chance of seeing solutions actually implemented. So that sort of writing I still read, but it's you know, it's not easy to keep up with it these days, coming at you from multiple directions. But the quality of the best of the writing out there, I think, is as good as it ever has been. And so to that extent, I'm, you know, reasonably optimistic that there's at least good material for policymakers to draw on, whether policymakers like those in the United States at the moment are in the slightest bit interested in drawing on good quality material is another question. But for the rest of us, it's there.
That's the paradox, right? While the media business model implodes, for consumers like you and me, it's not obvious there's a cost. In fact, if anything, the universe of things we can read and get access to has exploded.
Yeah, and there's at least as much good writing being written and being read as was ever previously the case. The trouble is, you've got to, you know, there's so much competition to get words out there that you've got to know where to find it or where to ensure that you get streamed to you. And there is that terrible disposition for so many people just to live in bubbles or silos or gated intellectual communities, listening only to that which they want to hear from sources they want to hear, and not getting a broader spread of it. And that's the challenge, of course, in the contemporary age. It's not the it's not the quantity. There's a stack of quantity out there. It's not the quality, because there's some first rate stuff out there. It's the it's the absence of any kind of, you know, filtering through sources of universally regarded credibility and reliability that some of the great world's newspapers used to be, and the, you know, the difficulty for the ordinary consumer, not the specialist, but the difficulty for the ordinary consumer to get a sort of a balanced assessment of the different currents of argument that are out there, and to make judgments accordingly.
Looking back on not just your period as foreign minister, but also at Crisis Group and your work with the ANU and your career generally, who would you nominate as the couple of the most impressive political leaders that you've seen close up, and why?
Oh, Mandela. Nelson Mandela sticks out in my mind, as he does in so many others. I mean, just for the totally impressive dignity and intelligence with which he, and bravery with which he handled his bishop position all those years, 27 years at Robben Island, you know, never ever losing sight of the main game, which was the absolute necessity for reconciliation of South Africans one with the other, and just that extraordinary set of human qualities that made it possible to manage a transition which everybody in the universe thought beforehand was going to be bloody in the extreme. So Mandela was fantastically impressive. And,
but that was a public aura. Did that work in the room as well?
Oh, yeah. I mean, I was one of the very first people to meet Mandela when he came out of jail, and he went just a few days afterwards up to Lusaka in Zambia, where I happened to be in the region, and I was really one of the first of all the international officials to meet him, and I sat down with him for over an hour in the presidential boardroom in Lusaka, and was just enchanted by the quality of the man, and just everything about him was just awesome. And you know, I've met him on a number of occasions when he came subsequently to Australia, and I've got a picture of me sitting with him on the steps of the Sydney Opera House on the cover of my book, and Hawkey's a bit upset about that because he thinks it was him, not unreasonably, it was the main mover in the Australian anti-apartheid campaign, financial sanctions and so on. But
well, he can write his own book.
Well, he has written his own book, and anyway, but I've given total credit to Hawkey. I mean, I think he was a, you know, a moral leader on that in the Commonwealth Forum. So Mandela was hugely impressive in a way that Suu Kyi has not been impressive. I mean, the contrast is interesting. I mean, I was passionately attached to the whole idea of Suu Kyi for the decades when she was, such a wonderful symbol against the brutality and oppression of the Burmese generals. But she's shown none of that sort of, that graciousness and capacity to grow in adversity that was so so magnificent about Mandela, with results that we're now seeing with the Rohingya horror. Look, there's a whole cast of other people I met who were sort of impressive in their own ways. I mean, probably the best of the U.S. Secretaries of State with whom I dealt was Jim Baker, who people don't think of as a great sort of charismatic character, but he was the absolute consummate professional and willing, despite his, conservative Republican instincts, willing to respond in an evidence-based way to problems, to change his mind on policy strategies as better arguments emerged. And he and Scowcroft and that crowd were probably the most professional and best of the Americans that I dealt with across both Republican and Democrat administrations. So there's a bunch of people, like that who I like Kofi Annan very much. I mean, I first got to know Kofi Annan when he was a not a low ranking, he was a senior bureaucrat in the UN system running peacekeeping, but nothing like the secular pope figure that he subsequently became, but a man of consummate dignity and decency and with a real, sort of passion to do the right thing, and, he was a total pleasure to work with when I spent a lot of time, most of it quixotic, in trying to come up with strategies to improve the operation of the UN system. So people like that. I mean, Ali Alatas, my friend and colleague from Indonesia, with whom I developed a wonderful rapport when we very soon found ourselves together as foreign ministers, both in 1988. We were appointed about the same time, and both had a very common view about what we needed to do to fix the then rocky, as so often, bilateral relationship. And we agreed to stop talking endlessly about the patient and try to recover it from illness, but just develop some ballast from the relationship and move on. And we worked very, very closely together, not only on the East Timor problem, about which there's a lot of misunderstanding to this day, which I write a lot about in my book, The Backstory to That, because Alatas was very, very committed to trying to get a decent set of outcomes there, as was I. But in particular, of course, was the Cambodian peace plan, and the relationship I had with Alatas was crucial to being able to play the role that Australia did in coming up with the key ideas about how to get the peace there and then to actually effectively implement them through the process which Alatas co-chaired. So, I mean, individuals like this were hugely impressive and great to work with, and there's quite a number of them in many parts of the world that stand out in my memory as important to being able to get things done.
So those are the best. Care to nominate the worst?
Well, I mean, where do you start? I mean, Chief Buthelezi in South Africa was at the polar extreme from Mandela, and I remember having a conversation with Her Majesty, which is not one that's not supposed to recount, but we got into this gig about who are the worst people we respectively ever met in our lives. And I'd just come back from a horror trip to South Africa, at which I'd been patronized by this character, Buthelezi, who made it a little meme to have in his palace in eastern part of the country sort of white servants, Wedgwood carpets and all the rest of the paraphernalia of the British club, but with a very definite role reversal, which would have been fine had it not been for then going into a meeting with him and his provincial ministers and being booed and hissed for the duration of our meeting because they didn't like what we were saying about the ANC and about the necessity for financial sanctions and so on. I mean, there's terrible people like Buthelezi. I mean, the Ceausescus, I met them when they came to Australia not long before they were entirely understandably bumped off in the Romanian Revolution. I met, obviously, some horror story people like the Khmer Rouge leadership with whom I negotiated. I mean, Khieu Samphan, I knew very well, as a sort of the intellectual leader of the Khmer Rouge, not the and always put on this air of that, you know, he was a gentleman that couldn't possibly have had anything to do with all those nasty stories about 2 million people being murdered. But you know, you knew you were dealing with the sort of the moral architect of the genocide, and but you deal with these characters because that's what pragmatic conduct of foreign relations is all about, getting results.
Now, you're almost out of time, but your earlier point about Aung San Suu Kyi prompts another broader question. What's the biggest thing you've changed your mind about lately in foreign policy terms?
Gee, well, I'm not sure I have changed my mind about very much. I mean,
Suu Kyi, perhaps?
No, I've been disappointed about Suu Kyi because I thought she would grow and develop. But I knew for decades, as anyone who's been following her, that she was essentially a Burman aristocrat who came from a family tradition that didn't have very much regard for the minorities around the, you know, the perimeters of the country, and had no affection at all for the Muslim minority in the country and the people of Rakhine State, the Rohingyas, and one hoped that the inherent, you know, decency would come through, but it manifestly hasn't. So is that you know, changing your mind or just being disappointed? I mean, I have this disposition, which is the theme of the book I've just published, to be optimistic, to look on the bright side, although I know that lends itself to parody, to always look at particular situations as if there is a, you know, a potential remedy, which even if it won't solve the problem, might at least contain it and stop it getting worse. So when you approach things, you know, with that sort of cast of mind, you tend to see the glimmers of light rather than the the acres of darkness that are manifestly there. And to always live in hope that bad behaviour will be followed by better behaviour over time. I mean, you know, have I changed my mind about America with the advent of Trump? No, not really, because the potential for America misreading the play and overdoing the America first stuff, the exceptionalism, the world leadership has always been there, as recently as Obama, for God's sake, the wonderful Barack Obama, saying in the context of the Trans-Pacific Partnership, we make the rules. China doesn't make the rules, we make the rules, which is one of the more cloth-eared things that would have been possible for anyone to say in the context of a China which is manifestly wanting to not only acquire some strategic space for itself in the region, but also to play itself into the role of global, you know, rule maker, not just rule taker. So, you know, one gets disappointed by all sorts of things, including, you know, the failure of Obama, you know, to follow through effectively on the nuclear agenda, to which he was nuclear disarmament, to which he was so obviously committed intellectually and emotionally, and to, you know, to be spooked out of making those changes to doctrine, no first use, and so on, which would have I think fundamentally changed the landscape and made it rather more difficult to slide back to where we now are on that particular brief. So look, one's constantly disappointed by failure of things to happen, but changing your mind on what the basic things are that we ought to be doing as an international community, right across that whole spectrum of public goods issues. No, I mean, the agenda is as clear in my mind as it ever was, and the process for getting there, the hard grind of, you know, getting agreement on key normative principles, then defining operational strategies and getting out and getting them embraced and accepted. Hard, grueling work is what the whole business is about. And we can't abdicate the responsibility to go on doing just that, just because we feel, you know, let down by the vagaries of historical evolution and performance. People are always going to let you down, but others, chances are always going to be there to lift ourselves up, and that's the way we've got to think about it.
Gareth Evans, thanks for your time.
Not at all. Good to talk to you, Sam.